Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for June 3rd, 2014. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'll be talking to Scott Early about a pressure-sensitive signaling network that keeps blood flowing in the brain. As blood pressure fluctuates, cerebral arteries respond to ensure that the brain has a constant flow of blood. Like other blood vessels, cerebral arteries have a double-walled structure. Endothelial cells line the inside of the vessel, and they're encircled by smooth muscle cells that contract and relax to control the diameter of the inside of the vessel. When blood pressure rises, the muscle cells contract to maintain a constant flow of blood through the vessels. This response to increased pressure requires the calcium channel TRPC6 and the non-selective cation channel TRPM4. But how the activities of these two channels are coordinated to drive vasoconstriction has not been clear. A new collaborative study from the labs of Scott Early and Mark Nelson delineates the signaling network linking the activities of these two channels to vasoconstriction. Early spoke to me from the University of Nevada School of Medicine in Reno. Hello, Dr. Early. Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Systemic blood pressure naturally fluctuates over the course of a day and with physical activity, stress, things like that. Given that proper blood flow is really important for brain function, how does the brain cope with changes in blood pressure?
The cerebral circulation has many unique autoregulatory features that allow blood pressure to remain constant. And so one thing that we need to keep in mind is that global blood flow to the brain, that's the total amount that enters and leaves the brain, is very constant throughout the day and does not change in response to stress or activity. Localized blood flow in the brain is very dynamic. So where that blood goes once it enters the brain is a very dynamic process. But this global blood flow entering and leaving the brain is very constant. And we can contrast that to blood flow to muscles. So in muscles, we know that activity dramatically increases blood flow. So for example, when we exercise, there's increased metabolic demand. Blood flow goes up to meet that metabolic demand. And we know that when that happens, you know, the muscles swell. The tissue actually becomes engorged with blood and gets bigger. And so if that happens in the brain, we're going to be in trouble because the brain is encased within the skull and there's no place for this swelling to take place. So now there are a number of mechanisms that contribute to this autoregulatory response, and the mechanism we studied was actually a mechanism we've known about for a long time. It was first reported by Sir William Bayliss back in 1902. And so what Bayliss discovered was that over a physiological range of pressures, blood vessels will constrict in response to increasing perfusion pressure. So we know that resistance to blood flow is inversely proportional to the luminal diameter. So as pressure goes up, vascular resistance goes up as the vessels constrict. And so this increased resistance limits increases in blood flow, which causes the blood flow to remain essentially constant over a wide range of perfusion pressures. So there's an exquisite matching of blood pressure to increases in vascular resistance that kind of keep everything the same. This response is independent of circulating factors or input from the autonomic nervous system or factors from the endothelium. So this response is intrinsic to smooth muscle cells and it's therefore called the vascular myogenic response.
So essentially the arteries in the brain constrict when blood pressure rises to maintain the constant blood flow and they dilate when blood pressure drops.
Yes. So the luminal diameter and therefore vascular resistance is matched to changes in perfusion pressure.
The arteries in the brain aren't responding to diffusible cues. They're responding to the mechanical force of the blood on the walls. How do the arteries sense that mechanical force and respond to changes in blood pressure?
That's the main question that we addressed in our paper. And so we've known for a while that smooth muscle cells in small cerebral arteries depolarize. The membrane will depolarize in response to increased pressure. And I think that was first shown back in the late 1980s and into the 1990s. And so we know that this membrane depolarization will activate voltage-dependent calcium channels located on the plasma membrane. And so this allows the influx of calcium, which causes contraction of the muscle and eventually vasoconstriction. What was not known was how intraluminal pressure caused the membrane to depolarize. And so what we discovered is that there's a very intricate force-sensing network in smooth muscle cells, involving several ion channels and cell surface receptors. So essentially what happens is that the increasing in blood pressure stretches the smooth muscle cells in the walls of the arteries, and this activates a stress-sensitive ion channel on the plasma membrane as well as a cell surface receptor. Basically, this generates both a calcium signal and the second messenger molecule IP3. So these two signals converge on IP3 receptors located on the sarcolemma, which essentially amplifies the signal, which causes then another type of ion channel called TRPM4 channels to open on the plasma membrane, and this causes an influx of sodium, which causes the membrane depolarization.
Mechanistically, how does stretching of the smooth muscle cells by the increased blood pressure cause calcium to flow into the cells?
So our data show that there are two components of this response. The first component would be TRPC6 channels. TRPC6 channels are mechanosensitive, and stretching of the channel allows calcium influx into the cell. The second component of this response would be a receptor we think is the angiotensin II AT1 receptor. It's a receptor that's sensitive to the drug losartan. And losartan, we know, is coupled to phospholipase C gamma 1. So activation of phospholipase C gamma 1 causes generation of IP3. IP3 binds to IP3 receptors. So now the calcium coming in through mechanosensitive TRPC6 channels also will stimulate IP3 receptors by a process called calcium-induced calcium release. So the combination of these two signals are sensed by IP3 receptors, which causes release of a larger calcium signal through IP3 receptors, which then activate TRPM4 channels. So essentially what we think is happening is the generation of IP3 and activation of these IP3 receptors is actually acting as an amplifier to increase the magnitude of the initial calcium signal through TRPC6 channels.
And then how does calcium activate TRPM4?
TRPM4 channels are unique amongst the TRP channels in that they're activated by calcium. And so we know it takes very large amounts of calcium to activate TRPM4, so calcium concentrations in the micromolar range. So we know that in smooth muscle cells, calcium never globally throughout the cell will never reach that micromolar range. So what we've shown previously is that TRPM4 channels are activated by localized calcium release through IP3 receptors. What we've shown here is that TRPM4 channels, TRPC6 channels, and IP3 receptors are all co-localized. So they're all within 40 nanometers of each other. So again, this calcium signal released from IP3 receptors is acting on TRPM4 channels. So once the TRPM4 channels are activated, they allow sodium influx, which then acts to depolarize the plasma membrane to cause vasoconstriction. And so if they were not co-localized, the calcium would disperse throughout the cell, and calcium would never get high enough to actually activate TRPM4 channels. So we believe this localization is necessary in order to achieve these high calcium nanodomains or microdomains to activate TRPM4 channels.
Does this same pressure sensing and response system operate in all types of arteries or just in the brain?
That's a great question, and we haven't looked in other vascular beds yet. In other vascular beds, for example, pulmonary arteries don't respond to pressure the same way. They don't constrict in response to pressure, at least under normal circumstances. And so this mechanism that we describe may not be in operation there. Now, skeletal muscle arteries, we talked about a little bit earlier how skeletal muscle responds to increasing cardiac output. And so skeletal muscle arteries dilate during exercise. So now it could be that there are other factors that override the myogenic response in these blood vessels, in vivo at least, or it may be that the pathway that we described is simply not present in these arteries. So that would be the subject of a further study, I think.
Do other blood vessels show the myogenic response? I'm just thinking about organs like kidneys, for example, mm-hmm. where increased blood pressure can really damage the organ. Do mm-hmm. blood vessels in kidneys respond to changes to increases in blood pressure by decreasing their diameter to control flow?
Yeah, definitely. Renal arteries exhibit myogenic vasoconstriction, and it's very important there, as you mentioned, to limit damage in response to increasing cardiac output. And so if you measured, say, changes in renal blood flow in response to exercise, they don't change very much. It remains essentially constant, much like it does in the brain. So most systemic arteries will exhibit myogenic vasoconstriction. If you take the artery out of the body, you mount it in a pressure myograph and increase the pressure, they will constrict in that circumstance in response to increasing pressure. So it appears that myogenic vasoconstriction is an intrinsic property of most, if not all, blood vessels, at least systemic blood vessels. Whether it's important in vivo or not is another question. The renal circulation has this property, and it is important there. We study it in the cerebral circulation for, you know, one simple reason. It's much easier to isolate the arteries from the brain than it is from the kidney. And renal arteries have their own unique properties. I mean, that's one thing that, as a vascular physiologist, it becomes very difficult to generalize the circulation because each organ system, each segment of the systemic circulation has its own unique properties. So I tend not to generalize. But I do think our preliminary data would say that it's similar in renal arteries and other vascular beds. I have no evidence to comment on that.
I, like probably many other non-specialists, just think, you know, an artery is an artery is an artery.
Well, even most people, you know, most physiologists will think that. So it's only that we few people in this really esoteric area, I think, that really are starting to develop this appreciation that there is considerable heterogeneity within the vascular system. And then, you know, with the genetic and transcriptomic methods that, you know, that we have available now, we can actually demonstrate that. People are going in and looking at the transcriptional profiles of arteries in different segments and showing that they're quite different. And those types of approaches will actually, I think, tell us a lot about what's going on in different segments of the vasculature.
Thank you, Dr. Early. Thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That was Scott Early discussing a paper published in the May 27th issue of Science Signaling by Gonzalez and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.